You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Refinancing your car at Kemba Financial Credit Union can get you quick access to cash to help manage high-rate debts and expenses. Get up to $500 next day cash back, plus no payments for 90 days, and take cash equity out. Make your car work for you and drive away with extra cash. Apply at Kemba.org. Restrictions apply. Offer ends April 30th, 2024. Federally insured by NCUA.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
From iHeartRadio and Doghouse Pictures, this is Fight Night. I'm Jeff Keating.
Well, I'm going to lay down my burdens.
Down by the river side.
Way down. Down.
When I first met Chicken Man back in 2003, he was actually Reverend Gordon Williams. He greeted me at his church, and we had our first interview together. After a few years, we'd become close friends. We broke bread together, we watched movies together, we talked about our family together, and he ended up counseling my life as well. I also got to know his family, his wife Dolores, his son Gordon Williams Jr., and his two daughters, Camilla and Barjona. Here I am with Dolores as we talk about the first time she met Gordon Williams.
I was working in the salon, doing what I do, first chair, right? So Gordon came in and told the receptionist that he had an appointment with me. And so I heard him, and I turned around and looked. I said, you know, like, and it was like he just felt me when I said that, because I'm looking kind of strange. At the time, I was trying not to do men's hair. You know, I was busy. And then he turned, he said, yes, my appointment is with Dolores. He came and he sat. And I began to notice him, which was really strange for me because I was busy and guys come in all the time and they would try to be at you and all that, but I wouldn't really, you know, fall at that particular time. But there were things that I began to notice about it. The way he was dressed, I mean, he was just immaculate, and he was, the colors were right, and it wasn't too much. It was just enough. He was just on it. That's all. So he told me what he wanted, and I cut his hair. And it just so happened that now I got two assistants, but both of them were busy at the time when it was time for him to get his hair shampooed. So who was left to shampoo his hair but me? So I took him, you know, to shampoo bowl, and then I really could check him out with shoes and everything else, you know. And so. When I finished with him, and he, you know, came back to the chair, and he says, I really enjoyed my shampoo and everything. He says, I would love to make another appointment with you. I said, well, you can. When you get ready to go out the door, she'll take the appointment for you. You know, like that. So that's how we met. You know, he started asking me to go out to dinner and all that. But I resisted him for a long time because the fact that I knew he was with somebody, you know. And so I didn't want to get into all of that. But he wouldn't give up. Yeah, he wouldn't give up on it.
So tell me about the early years of Dolores and partying and your heyday. What was that like?
Well, it was amazing. Like I said, immediately when I opened the salon, it was so popular. And so anybody was would come to town, all of the new people, they would want to come there. And so it was, we worked hard and we partied hard.
So at what point, you know, when you guys are dating, like who starts to lean into
you know, Jesus and the Lord first? Is it you? Is it, are you doing it,
it was
this?
Me.
Okay, you.
It
okay, so me. Tell me about kind of what led you down that path and then how you kind of pulled Gordon in with you.
Okay, well, you know, after a while, I knew that he cared for me. I really did. I knew he cared for me. But he had all so much going on in his life. So he was going back and forth, you know, with his business and all that. But it got to the point where he would, when he was in town, he was going to make sure he came by the salon. And he finally convinced me to go out with him. And I did. And he was such a gentleman. I mean, he would make you love him. You know, he would really do that. He was free-hearted. He was a gentleman, and he would take it to the best of places. And to see a man with his capabilities and his personality and everything, you could easily fall in love with him. And so that's what happened. And then after we were together for a while, he came out here and bought me this house, and I've been in here ever since. You know, like the kids were saying, well, they came later. But we'd gone through quite a few things, the breaking up and with me getting saved and everything. You know, I got saved, changed my life.
So now at some point, you're married and you got two young girls.
Yes.
Okay,
yes,
gotcha. And so tell me a little bit about finally, you know, because again, this is a long process where Gordon realizes, hey, if I'm going to be with this lady and these two young girls, I got to give up this life. So tell me how that happens. And like, were you around for the thing where he owed like hundreds of thousands of dollars? Yeah, that was a scary time. Okay, so tell me, that's important because this is a story that he tells. And so tell me about what was going on and how you were feeling and how he was handling all that. Because that was, I mean, that's a close to death situation.
Well, at this particular time, you know, it was still a thing of him, you know, going back and forth. He was working, you know, kind of work he was doing. And, but it was just getting, you know, the people that he was dealing with, you could just tell that things were. And then I was able to see these things, you know, so I would be trying to warn him in advance, even though I wasn't with him all the time. But I said, you know, this and that and that. And this. So they anyway, they tricked him and ended up putting him in a bad situation. So he was focusing a lot on getting that together, which was the righteous thing to do, you know. And but at the meantime, he had a bullet that had been in his leg for a long time. And while this thing,
what was that from the war or from the streets?
No, from the streets.
He got shot. Yes. So how did that happen?
I think a friend of his or something. They were either together and somebody got mad but at the time they were, you know, doing what they do. And
so he gets shot and he's got a bullet in his leg.
Yeah, got a bullet in his leg. And he went to the hospital for it, but he wouldn't even stay there long enough for them to get it out.
Okay.
You know, he just felt just left with it. Now, this was before I met him. Now.
Yes, I understand.
And so he left with the bullet in his leg. And I guess he felt that he was all right, so he never saw about it. But at this particular time, when he's down there and he's under a lot of stress because they're trying to settle this thing, trying to find these people that stole all the stuff. And they ended up, the bullet popped out of his leg.
Is he bleeding?
Yes, he was bleeding. So he ended up in the hospital.
Oh, my goodness.
And when he went to the hospital, well, they kept him there and they cleaned him up and all that kind of stuff. But he stayed. So that's when he sent for me to come down there because, again, you know, and so I went. And
when you say down there, do you mean to Miami?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Gotcha. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. But he came out and, you know, and it was just such a terrible time.
You know, most of the time when you're in a life of crime, Dolores, it's very hard to get out.
It is.
When Gordon is dealing with a high level situation, a lot of money that he owes for drugs, that's just what it was.
Yes,
he's got somebody that stole it from him. And,
yes.
and more importantly, they're giving him this ultimatum. And he talks about this, bring me this guy's head in a paper bag and everything's okay. And Gordon isn't a murderer. So he's like saying,
that's
hey, listen,
right.
Exactly. I got it. So now he's got to clear this debt. So he's got to sell more drugs to clear this debt.
Yes.
But normally after you do that, it's so hard to get out. So finally he pays this debt, but how does he get out of this life?
I'm so glad that you brought that to my memory. When we came home, then he began to all the contacts or whatever he had to get rid of stuff. This is what he began to do. So when he got the money, all that he needed to pay them, I remember I drove that road down with him. We rode down to Miami and he met with them and he paid them. And they would say, "Oh, Gordon, yeah, this and that," you know, like they were so happy. They'd go, "What else we can do?" He turned around and put his hand on his butt and say, "You can kiss." In other words, he was through.
Yeah.
He was through with it, and he did not look back.
So what you're telling me is after he pays that off and he's like, "Kiss my, you know what," he literally is be able to cut it all off?
He did.
Here I am with Gordon Williams Jr. as he talks about how his father's lifestyle affected him as he grew older.
At the time, I'm taking his place. So I'm selling kilos like crazy.
Sins of the father.
Yeah, I'm following in my dad's footsteps. Then I get busted in Henry County. And it's one of the largest drug busts in Henry County on record.
Yeah.
It was a guy who's driving for me. But he got caught with 29 kilos, and he told them it was mine. So they picked me up and charged me with conspiracy. So that was kind of like the catalyst for my dad, because it really hurt him. Because now the feds got me. When the feds get you, the feds got you. I started off in Georgia Penitentiary.
How long did you have to serve?
10 years, 6 months, and 21 days.
That's a real deal right there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that really hurt my dad, you know, because I'm his firstborn.
Of course. You're the prince.
And for me to follow in his footsteps and to fall like that changed his whole world. And he came to court. In my defense, I was sentenced on my birthday, September the 9th, 1995. Prior to that, he had stopped using.
By the time you get to court, he's clean.
He's clean.
Yeah.
He's clean.
Yeah.
The judge that sentenced me just happened to go to school with my mom.
Okay. So he knows about you.
So he knows about me.
Yeah.
Yeah, he knows about me. And he knows about my dad.
Yeah.
So they asked, do anybody want to say anything before they pass sentencing? And my dad gets up and says, "Your Honor, I'd like to speak on my son's behalf and tell you that he's not bad and he needs a second chance. And if you allow him the second chance, he'll do right by you." And he said, "I'm going to throw myself on the mercy of the court that please don't sentence him." Because they were asking for a lot of time for me. They was asking for
30 years?
They was asking for 25 to life.
25 to life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He told my dad, "Well, Mr. Williams, go take everything in consideration. And I'm going to sentence your son underneath the guidelines. Because the guidelines are calling for 25 to life. I'm going to give him 15 years. And they gave me 15. I served 10 on it. I was in Atlanta waiting to move. And they had a prayer service down there for the inmates. And they said, "Anybody want to go to prayer service?" I said, "Yeah, you know, I'd go." And when I went down to prayer service, guess who was there?
Your father.
My dad. He was running the outreach prison ministries for inmates. And when he saw me, because I didn't know he was coming, and I didn't know he was, you know, I didn't know he was going to be there. And when I went in, he started crying. You know, he's like, "Golly, man." Then he started getting closer and closer to the Lord and started really confessing his sins his life started changing. And then that's when he opened up the church, International Ministries 2000.
Did he ultimately get ordained?
Yeah, he did.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He's an ordained minister. Yeah. He was an ordained minister when he died.
Yeah.
He went theological. He went to Morehouse over there. And I was like, wow, what a turnaround from a drug dealer to a reverend. And he said, "Yeah, you know, I opened up my own church. I'm minister." I said, "Really? Okay, cool." When I got out August the 30th, 2006.
2006, yeah.
So when I got out, I went to the church. So he wanted me to minister to the younger guys in the congregation, because they didn't understand what it was like, you know, to be out here and selling drugs and doing wrong. And he said, "You can give them a message that they'll listen to because you've experienced it." Because my dad never did federal time. He never went to prison for as long as I did.
Yeah.
So he said that I had something to offer. So, and I started, you know, I started ministering to the younger groups there. And it was strange seeing my dad transform like that. That was a really strange transformation I witnessed. Because prior to me leaving, he was, you know, I mean, Chicken Man, you know.
And when you came out, he was what?
Reverend Williams. He was Reverend Williams when I came on. He had let that old name die. I mean, but you can't get rid of it. I said, you're going to be Chicken Man for life. I don't care. I mean, that's what people are going to know you. And people was questioning whether his faith was real or not, because they just didn't want to believe it, because they knew him prior to meet this man afterwards. And he's talking about worshiping God and praying and healing. And it didn't set well with a lot of people.
When did you know that the transformation was real?
When him and Dolores stopped using drugs, when they gave their life to Christ, I knew it was real. I knew it was real.
Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Nobody wants to outlive their money, but it happens, especially for women. That's why Gainbridge offers the Parity Flex annuity. It's designed for women's unique retirement needs, with flexible withdrawals to help cover unexpected expenses, plus a guaranteed lifetime income benefit that keeps paying you even if your account balance is zero. In other words, it's like getting a paycheck for life. We'll say that again. A paycheck for life. Guaranteed. Sounds too good to be true? It's not. It's the Parity Flex annuity. And it's one more example of their commitment to creating a better financial future for women. One where they feel empowered, not excluded, and ready to take on whatever their next chapter holds. Gainbridge believes financial flexibility and security are things we all could use more of. At retirement income you can't outlive is the ultimate flex. Who's with us? Start saving now at Gainbridge.io. Please visit Gainbridge.io/ParityFlex for current rates, for product disclosures and disclaimers, and other important information.
I also stayed in touch with J.D. Hudson over the years, and I was shocked to learn about an incredible event that happened to him, but not surprised by the outcome. I connected with his daughter, Renee, as she told me about who J.D. was as a father and what it was like being the daughter of a policeman.
The time that I was in high school, my father at that time was a school detective.
What does that mean? And where was that?
Back then, all the schools had cops assigned to the school. So if they had problem kids or whatever, if there was some kind of ruckus going on or whatever, they were assigned to certain high schools. And my father was assigned to the high school that I went to.
Renee, you think he did that for...
Can you imagine that?
Yeah, do you think he did that for a reason?
I don't know.
I think you did. I know your dad.
Oh, God. It was just, you know, and everybody. So I didn't have a whole lot of friends.
Of course not. You got this cop that is... So now maybe some girlfriends that didn't want to, you know, that were, was straight laced, but no guys are going to be like trying to ask.
That's true.
Oh my goodness. That's so funny. Yeah. That is a JD move if I've ever heard one.
Oh my God.
Tell me a little bit about your father. What kind of dad was he? What do you remember about him growing up? What were some things that you remember of being the daughter of JD Hudson?
I love my father. I thought he was a good dad. He was a hard worker. He worked a lot, you know, excellent provider. Oh, he loved holidays. He loved Christmas. His favorite color was blue. So I love Christmas too, but everything was blue. We had blue lights. We had a blue wreath. We had blue bulbs. We had blue tinsel on the Christmas tree. And so I said, when I grow up, I'm never having anything blue because he loved blue. But he loved the holidays. He loved Christmas. He loved wrapping gifts. He and my uncle, they would play on my brother's toys before my brother and I would wake up for Christmas. He would always take us on vacation. Back then, things were segregated. He loved to go to Jekyll Island, and there was a black side of Jekyll Island and a white side of Jekyll Island. We'd, you know, drive to Florida. There were a lot of places we couldn't stop. I remember once we stopped somewhere and we got gas, and the guy came out and called my father the N-word. And so my daddy told him, "You siphon all this gas out of my car." That's when I kind of realized the world was not the same everywhere, you know, because I had been so insulated because in the area that I lived in, it was all black. He just always taught me to be kind to everyone, you know, not to hate. He wanted me to do well in school. I think he was a pretty nice dad. The only thing about being my father's daughter was that it prevented me from having a lot of friends. A lot of people wouldn't come over because my dad, you know, he started out being a cop, you know, then when he was over the Bureau of Corrections, oh my God, you know. And so people shied away from me. It was different from my brother. Now, my brother, that was a different story. But for me, oh my goodness, you know. I just say, I love daddy, but golly, I wish he wasn't a cop.
Walk me through where you were or when you heard about when the guys tried to take the Cadillac from your dad's garage.
I was in Conyers and I drove over here. And by the time I got here to the house, they had taken my father to the hospital. So then I drive to Grady. And I'm frantic. And I asked them, I'm trying to find the gentleman that got shot and was just brought in by the ambulance. And they said, there are two people that just got shot. I said, what are you talking about? She said, there are two people on whatever floor or an emergency. They're side by side. You want the young man or the older man? And so I said, what do you mean there are two people? So I said, you need to tell the cops if there are two people that got shot, more than likely that person that's sitting next, that's laying next to my dad, is the person that shot him. They said, oh, ma'am. So I ran to my father and I said, oh, my God. And do you know the man that shot my daddy was right next door? And when he heard me telling the nurses, you need to find that guy because he shot my dad, he ran out of the hospital.
Well, they caught the guy. You know that, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And then there was two
guys. But Daddy,
guys.
And they had a trial, but Daddy didn't tell me anything.
Why?
And they didn't go because I wanted to go, but they, I don't know. And so by the time I found out, they had already had a trial.
And did you know that there was two people that were shot? One was killed.
Yeah. See, this is the mistake that Daddy made. Daddy was in his Cadillac. My brother believed it was an intentional hit on my dad. And so Daddy drove into the driveway and he made the cardinal mistake of not letting the garage door down. So he was sitting in the car with the radio on, smoking a cigar. And these two guys with masks, which is strange, came up, one to the left and one to the right. Both cars were in the garage. And you've been over here before, so you know it's not that much space between the wall and the car parked and the other side, because Mama's car was on the right-hand side. And they pointed the gun at my dad, oh, man, get out of the car. And Daddy just happened to have his service revolver. You know how they have this little pocket on the door, on the left side of the door, on the driver's side. So that's when he pulled that gun up and he shot him. And then he got the car and shot the other one. And so then Daddy, my mama had just come from abroad. Somebody had just dropped her off. She had just walked in the door and she was taking her clothes off. And she heard the gunshot. She came to the door with her underwear on. He told her, get back in the house. And she closed the door and called the police, called 911. So the guy runs out, he shoots one guy, and then one guy falls down. I think he died. He shot him, and he fell right before he got to Cascade Road. So he got as far as he could to Beach Trace and fell over. on the ground. So I think that's the one that died.
How was your dad's recovery?
The gunshots, they didn't hit any organs, but I believe they poisoned his system. And I think that was the reason that daddy died.
He was a tough man, your dad.
Yeah, I think he had four gunshots, three or four. I can't remember.
He was definitely shot a few times. I remember that. Yeah. I still have the article. Any closing words you want to say about J.D. Hudson?
I loved him dearly. I think he was an excellent role model. It was wonderful being his daughter. He was a very affectionate, kind man. And every Christmas I think about him because he really, really loved Christmas. I didn't have a lot of boyfriends. I'm going to cry. But my daddy always gave me something for Valentine's Day. He always made sure I had a heart-shaped thing of candy, you know, and just the little things like that. You know, he was just he was a nice daddy. He was so affectionate and so thoughtful, and I just miss him.
Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cash back on purchases. And pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Nobody wants to outlive their money, but it happens, especially for women. That's why Gainbridge offers the Parity Flex annuity. It's designed for women's unique retirement needs, with flexible withdrawals to help cover unexpected expenses, plus a guaranteed lifetime income benefit that keeps paying you even if your account balance is zero. In other words, it's like getting a paycheck for life. We'll say that again. A paycheck for life. Guaranteed. Sounds too good to be true? It's not. It's the Parity Flex annuity. And it's one more example of their commitment to creating a better financial future for women. One where they feel empowered, not excluded, and ready to take on whatever their next chapter holds. Gainbridge believes financial flexibility and security are things we all could use more of. At retirement income you can't outlive is the ultimate flex. Who's with us? Start saving now at Gainbridge.io. Please visit Gainbridge.io/ParityFlex for current rates, full product disclosures and disclaimers, and other important information.
Here I am with Gordon's oldest daughter, Camilla, as she reflects on who he was as a father.
Growing up with Gordon Williams as a father, I think one thing that sticks out to me is just the excitement of knowing when he was coming home. He had a signature whistle that he did. I can't whistle, but it always said, boo, boo, boo. That was his way of letting us know that he was in the house. And I just remember anytime I heard that whistle, I just got so excited. He was very kind and loving. He trusted us in a weird way, you know, even as children, to make good decisions. He had a way of guiding you without, you know, dictating. He wanted you to learn and live your life, but he was always there to drop those jewels of wisdom. You know, one thing I always noticed that a lot of people always loved him too, that he was loved by a lot of people. You know, even when we were at gas stations or just random places that I didn't even know that people would know who he was, somebody would come up and give him a handshake or a hug or just have something good to say about him.
And what do you remember him in your early years being a reverend and his community and affiliation with the church?
I remember him younger being more involved in like the prison ministry. I remember admiring his love for working with the prisoners. And I do remember like events they would have at the church at Salem. And I remember one event in particular, like a bunch of prisoners were able to come to the church during the service. And I remember him, you know, being involved in that. And I was just thinking, wow, this is really dope, you know, for this to be happening. So things like that, I definitely admired with him in the church. I didn't really hear him speak a lot growing up, but I just saw more of his actions being done.
Tell me a little bit, are some of the memories that you remember, either maybe between you and your dad or family members or a trip, but what's one or two things that stands out?
What sticks out with me was in his elder years when he was having bouts of like dementia. One of the things was I used to like to put him in the car and put on Isley Brothers, For the Love of You. And he would kind of just be present, you know. Somehow it made him, if he was having issues remembering, or, you know, sometimes that would really frustrate him. And he might be in not one of his best moods because he wanted to be, you know, fully strong mentally and physically. But I remember when he would kind of just be able to sit back in the car, and I remember just riding, asking where he want to go eat, what he feel like eating, and, you know, being able to take him out to eat, roll the windows down and just put on some Isley Brothers, and he would just be present, you know, be there in the moment. And that brought me a lot of joy.
And this is Gordon's youngest daughter, Barjona, with her insights on her father.
He was just a really kind and wise father. Like, I don't remember him yelling at me or being kind of a disciplinarian. It was more so if he wanted me to do something, he kind of just told me. And he could, you know, he just had a way with words where he could make you understand what he meant pretty easily and make you want to follow it. And I remember towards the end of his life, he would just tell us the same things over and over and over again. Like, he just would say, stay focused. Every time I talked to him on the phone, every time I see him, he would say, Barjona, stay focused. And so things like that just resonated with me throughout my life, you know, as I go on my journey.
Tell me about some memories you have of maybe a trip that you guys took, or a family dinner, or something that stands out.
One of my best memories is just eating dinner. My dad was really big about us sitting down at the table as a family and eating together, which is something I don't necessarily always do with my family now, but my dad really valued that. So whether it didn't matter what we were eating, he just wanted us to sit down as a family. We would end up sitting at the table for hours, just talking, having conversation. And that gave us so much time to really get to know each other and keep up on what each other had going on throughout the day.
So as far as back as you can remember, was your dad always a reverend, or did he become a reverend at some point as you grew up?
As far as I can remember, he was always involved in the church in some way. I remember him being a deacon. I think that's my earliest memory of him. He worked as a deacon, and he was the guy in the church that we would say always had all the keys. So it's like he drove the church van. He was just always involved in the church.
And which church was that when you were growing up?
Well, when we were growing up, we went to Salem, and he was very involved there. He worked as a deacon, and then he also participated in the prison ministry. And then he also worked at a rehab house, like a drug rehab house off Bankhead that he headed up. So sometimes we would go to work with him there, and he did a lot of counseling with people in the community. So I always remember him being involved in the community and with the church, and, you know, just trying to lend a helping hand to younger males especially.
And at what point, as you started to grow up, did you realize that your dad had a former life different than the one he was leading now as a hustler?
I would say when I really found out, Jeff, was when I met you and you started bringing around like newspaper clippings and things like that. I mean, before then, I knew people called him Chicken Man, and I had heard kind of stories about his life, but I wasn't exactly sure that he was like a hustler until I got to high school and people started showing so much interest in his story. And that's when I started learning more. Honestly, I feel like I'm still learning a lot about who he was. And if you ask different people, you get a different response. And with me being like his last child, I was born so late in his life. I think the version of my dad that I got was like this homebody minister. So I was kind of shocked to know that he was involved in all these different enterprises, I would say, as a young man.
What were some of the things that your dad talked about as growing up as a Black man in Atlanta, or some of the racial things that he dealt with growing up? Did he broach those subjects at all?
My dad, he more so talked about race, and I think this is true of him and my mom, from their own perspective. Like, it was never more so about like how they were treated by white people. It was more so what their own reaction to it was. We just kind of knew you work for yourself. One thing that he told me is that he felt that Black people were better off before integration because they had a stronger sense of entrepreneurship and community. That's what he told me about race, but never really from the perspective that I should look out for any race over another, but just more so that if you're going to be a Black person in America, you have to stand up for what you believe in, and you have to really know your value in the workplace and not allow people to use you because you're bringing value to whatever you do.
Did you ever see him give any sermons?
Oh, yes, definitely.
So what kind of preacher was he?
My dad was the most laid back preacher, like almost too laid back. Like, he would just, like I said, he just talked to you. He wasn't going to yell at you. He wasn't going to hoop and holler. He was going to have an outline and give you some good tidbits. And he might speak for 30 minutes, but it's always going to be like one thing you remember, you know. But I remember at the end of each sermon, he would always say, and remember, only what you do for Christ will last. More so than a preacher, he was a counselor. You know, he was the type that after he gets off the pulpit, then everybody wants to go talk to him, you know, get advice from him, tell them about his day, you know, about their day. I would say just a kind and caring type of preacher, not somebody who's going to condemn you for the things you did wrong, but more so understanding. And he would always just tell me, you know, people are just people. They're always going to disappoint you. You can't hold people to this high standard and expect them to be perfect. You'll always be disappointed. You just have to let people be who they are. So that's how he really operated as a minister as well.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound to save a wretch like me.
When I found out that Gordon got Parkinson's, I was really bummed. I went to visit him at the VA hospital right near where my parents lived. He was weak, but he gathered his strength to speak with me one last time. We shared a quiet moment of reflection, and I said my goodbyes. Here is his family talking about the last days they were with him at the hospital. This is Camilla.
I remember a particular in his very last days is when I went to see him in the hospital, and I think this is the same day that he passed that night. But when I got there that morning, I remember when I walked in, you know, just you could tell he was extremely weak. But I remember I was holding his hand, I had been reading to him and things like that, and then he started to move a little bit in his face, and I just remember looking, thinking, oh my God, I think he's about to open his eyes. And you could tell that it took a lot of effort, but he opened his eyes, and it was just like for a second. But I remember I was smiling, and all the nurses came in, and they were so happy, you know, that he opened his eyes. And so that definitely sticks out to me. And he had a way of getting you to learn a lesson. And from that, I just always remember thinking I could do anything, you know, because he was so strong to even be on his deathbed and work so hard to be able to see me one more time. It let me know that I can't make excuses with life. I just gotta persevere no matter what. And like he always told us, to stay focused and keep moving forward, even in the last days, you know, you can still accomplish what it is you want to accomplish, even if that's just opening your eyes to see your family.
And this is Barjona.
Well, it seems like those years went by fast, from when he was like diagnosed with Parkinson's to his health beginning to decline. When he got to the end of his life where he couldn't say much, even when I would call to talk to my mom on the phone, I could hear him in the background being like, stay focused. So he was just trying to give us those last, you know, messages of who he wanted us to be and, you know, make that contribution to our life. And I really appreciate that at this age. You know, sometimes I wish he was still here, but I think he left us with so many, you know, nuggets of wisdom.
And this is his wife, Dolores, talking about the last moments of his life.
He was okay. You could see that he had peace in his heart. He had peace in his mind, you know, and he told me he was ready to go. I said, no, I'm trying to, no, you're not ready to go. I said, you can't leave me. I said, you can't leave me with these girls. That's what I said. He told me, no, y'all going to be all right. Y'all going to be all right. He was really ready to go.
And here is Gordon Williams Jr. as he was with his father at the end.
When they had to put him on a respirator is when it really hit me that it was coming to an end. So we all went to, because he died in South Fulton Hospital on Cleveland Avenue. So we all went there, and when we got there, he was, you know, they had him on the respirator and had him on the breathing machine and stuff like that. That was real difficult. That was real difficult looking at my dad like that. But I knew that the end was near. He motioned for me to come, you know, and I went over to his bedside, and Dolores was on this side and I was on that side. And I grabbed his hand, and he squeezed my hand, and he took his last breath. And that was it. That was something else.
He's a good man. He's a good man.
I once was lost, but now I'm found. Blind, but now I see.
Fight Night is a joint production from iHeartRadio, Will Packer Media, and Doghouse Pictures in association with Psychopia Pictures. Produced and hosted by Jeff Keating. Executive producers are Will Packer, James Lopez, Kenny Burns, Dan Bush, Lars Jacobson, and Noel Brown. Supervising producer is Taylor Chicoine. Story editors are Noel Brown and Dan Bush. Written by Jeff Keating and Jim Roberts. Edited by Matt Owen. Mixing and sound design by Jeremiah Kulani Prescott. Music written and performed by the Diamond Street Players. Additional music by Ben Lovett. Audio archives courtesy of WSB News, Film, and Videotape Collection, Brown Media Archives, University of Georgia Libraries. Special thanks to Dr. Maurice Hobson and David Davis.
Fight Night is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, check out the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Do Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cash back on purchases. And pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Nobody wants to outlive their money, but it happens, especially for women. That's why Gainbridge offers the Parity Flex annuity, designed for women's unique retirement needs, with flexible withdrawals plus a guaranteed lifetime income benefit that keeps paying you even if your account balance is zero. Gainbridge is helping build a better financial future for women. Retirement income you can't outlive is the ultimate flex. Start saving now at Gainbridge.io. Visit Gainbridge.io/ParityFlex for current rates, full product disclosures and disclaimers, and other important information.